let's go back to what you were saying about stuff in your home. Your fridges and your washing machines, all those things are made in factories. And here in Australia, often a lot of that is made overseas, so knowing who's making it is really hard to keep track of.
And when we buy things for the house, we're involved in this supply and demand system, and we become part of what's called a supply chain. But as Emmanuel Josserand from the UTS Business School says, a supply chain isn't as black and white as buying a washing machine.
So basically, it's all the steps that you have different actors intervening along these steps that come from raw materials to an end product that will be distributed to a customer. So there are very long supply chains. For instance, if you look at computers, you would start by minerals that can be extracted in Africa, and that's included in components, and you have different level of assembly of this component, and these components are sold to another group of companies that will bring them together and manufacture maybe an iPhone that is then sold by Apple. And what we see is, you know, Apple and the brand and the iPhone, but obviously that goes all the way back to people working in the mines in Congo, which is a very bad example of, you know, non-sustainable practices, by the way.
But not everything we buy comes from factories.
If you're looking at vegetables, they are grown in Australia, and they are often supplied directly from big farming operations to retailers who would use their own logistics to bring that to shops.
So someone that grows local produce might come from a smaller supply chain than, say, a long supply chain conglomerate like Apple.
But as Sarah Kane from the UTS Business School says, length isn't the only difference between short and long supply chains.
There's a difference also, though, in terms of corporate social responsibility and how organisations deal with supply chains. So often we see large organisations able to monitor the first tier of their supply chain. So if they have a very complex supply chain, it becomes difficult for the main organisation, say Apple's the example we use, for them to monitor everything that's down a complex supply chain. It's very often you're able to see, take garments for example, the first tier of your supply chain, but delving deeper is where it starts to be more tricky and where you start to see some of the less sustainable practices, both in terms of the environment and in terms of people. So the length of the supply chain has big implications for corporate social responsibility for those organisations at the top of those supply chains.
And when a supply chain is global, things can get a bit tricky.
So then you start to get, you know, a range of factors that impact on labour standards, including jurisdictional issues. Not only do you have geographical dispersion of workers, you also have a range of different jurisdictions that apply. So you start to get a complexity in the type of regulation that's applied. You also tend to get difficulties arise from the types of workers that are engaged at different parts of the supply chain. So a case that we've been dealing with looks at migrant workers, migrant Vietnamese workers in Thailand and Malaysia. And once you start to get groups of migrant workers who perhaps don't know their rights, you start to get issues of those rights not being honoured in certain circumstances.
When we're talking about migrant labourers, many of these people can't even speak the language of the country they're in, let alone know their own legal rights. Here's Emmanuel.
In the case of the fruit and vegetable picking situation, there was something like this. Even here, there was nobody to tell them what they should have obtained. And so that can result in practices that range from, you know, probably not paying the right wage or making people work longer hours to really much more dramatic, not that these are acceptable, but much more dramatic situation where people are used as slaves. They pay huge price to get their ticket to go to another country. They have to pay back this debt, so they are bound labor. They are poorly treated. They can be beaten up. They can't change employers. They have no freedom. And obviously, you know, not to mention basic rights, such as the right to freely associate, to fight for their rights. I mean, that doesn't happen at all. And in the worst cases, well, something bad happened at work, they get sick, and they are left to die. So that it can become very quickly highly dramatic.
So we know that ethical supply chains are an important social justice issue, but why are they a sustainability one?
When we're talking about sustainability, increasingly there's an understanding that environmental sustainability is only one part of that discussion, only one part of the sustainability pie, and that both the sustainability of labour, the sustainability of people, the sustainability of communities is very much tied in with environmental sustainability, and that if you don't think of sustainability holistically, you may actually end up with initiatives that, you know, might be looking at environmental sustainability but don't take into account people, and they might be working against each other. So it kind of, to me, underpins everything else that happens. And also, if you're to get local buy-in to anything to do with environmental outcomes, people are going to need to feel that they have a living wage, that their families are going to be looked after as a minimum before their minds are going to turn to environmental considerations.
There are three players at hand here when monitoring unethical supply chains, according to Emmanuel.
One is governments, and that's your very important aspect of the issue. Governments have a role to play, and that's through public procurement enforcement in their own country, but also participating in trade agreements that are more and more that include more and more aspects on social justice. Then you have the consumer power. You have a campaign, and then people start to pay more attention and, you know, buy products based on that. Obviously, that will have an impact. And the third power is labor. You want to organize these three. One of the issues around the governance gap is how to bring the three together.
And how do you bring the three together?
That is the $6 million question, and the research we've been conducting has very much been looking at different attempts to do this. Many people, many organisations recognise the problems. It's how to go about rectifying them that poses the challenge. And if we take labour standards, which we've been looking at in particular, there are lots of organisations who have an interest, and in fact there are quite a few governance mechanisms that theoretically apply to make sure that this kind of exploitation doesn't happen. The problems that we have is in having those enforced or implemented on the ground. If you don't have workers, as you've already described, who know their rights, workers who are somehow enfranchised to take some kind of action to receive those rights, then all of those governance mechanisms really don't count for much. And so you have these workers, the most disenfranchised workers, falling between those gaps. We call it the governance gap. And that's the big issue. Not so much saying that we need more and more governance, but how do we even enforce what we've already got?